listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
And joining me now from Ireland is the Executive Director of GenSpect, Stella O'Malley. Stella, thank you so much for being with us here on RCR. First, let's have a little back summary. I know you've talked on RCR before, but tell us about your organisation. What is GenSpect and what's the work that you do?
Well, GenSpect was created in 2021, and we created it to offer a non-medicalized approach to gender distress. In the last about 10 years, you know, this trans phenomenon has really just exploded, and very few people kind of knew very much about it, myself included. I'm a psychotherapist. But for a series of reasons, I ended up in the middle of working with not only people who were, you know, gender distressed, but also detransitioners, parents of kids who had gender distress, a whole kind of raft of different people who are impacted by gender dysphoria. And as a result, we set up GenSpect to say, well, what about a non-medicalized approach? It's almost like with depression. You can use antidepressants, of course you can, and they can be very effective. And you can use even more extreme things like people have ECT. The same with your gender identity. Some people might want to medicalize it. They might want to have mastectomies. They might want to have puberty blockers and stop their sexual development. Well, other people might be interested in developing other ways to manage their pain and maybe to move out of it, because there's lots of ways into pain and lots of ways out of it. And I'd be kind of quite well informed in that because I'm a psychotherapist. So we formed GenSpect, and it's been going extremely well. It got very big, very, very fast. I didn't expect that. And so we are a pretty big organization now. We have a wing in New Zealand. We have a wing in Australia. We have all over the world, basically. People who are joining together saying, well, why not treat this as a social and psychological issue that can be helped?
So when the CAS report, this long piece of research led by respected pediatrician Hilary Cass, came out in, what was it, April of this year, did you regard that as a major breakthrough?
I did. Everything in the Hilary Cass report was basically a vindication of what we'd been saying since 2021. Hilary Cass spent 4 years. She was a completely independent and very eminent, highly respected pediatrician in the UK. And she, it was funny, she was just coming up to retirement, and she was offered a kind of, you know, an interesting project is what she thought. And she thought she'd be maybe given every Thursday for the next few months to it. And it turned out it took over her life for the next 4 years. She was given a team, and she studied gender affirming treatment for children and adolescents in the UK. And this was an extremely comprehensive study. She looked at everything. She was completely neutral. She had no kind of side going into this. And when she came out with a report after 4 years of full-time study, it was a very clear message that there is no supporting evidence to show that we should be medicalizing gender identity. There is no long-term evidence. There's no quality evidence. There is no reason other than people feel that it will be a good idea. We don't have any research or long-term evidence to back up and support. These are really radical interventions. And the Hilary Cass report, we were thrilled when it came out. We were absolutely thrilled, because it's like now we have hard data that shows there's no research. Because it's very hard to say there's no research when you've got nothing to back it up. Now we have the most eminent research in the world to back up our point, which is saying there's no research to support these very invasive treatments.
Well, there's been quite a lot of pushback against it, as you can imagine. In fact, I was reading on a website here in New Zealand last night. The website is called gayexpress.co.nz. So I guess you can understand what I'm about to tell you, or you will probably predict what I'm about to tell you. The CAS report I'm quoting from this column on gayexpress.co.nz, the CAS report's critics point to a troubling absence of transparency when it comes to the report's expert advisory team. The CAS report does not constitute authoritative guidelines or provide an accurate observation of the available medical evidence on the treatment of gender dysphoria, and ignores other positive research. Now, that is not an untypical piece of pushback against this report, is it? What do you say to people writing that kind of material when this CAS report is really the end result of what, 4 years, 3 years of exhaustive research?
There's a few things to say about that. Number one, I'm saddened that it's Gay Express that came out with that statement, because an awful lot of these kids who, you know, identify as trans, an awful lot of them are gay and lesbian and bisexual kids who don't want to be gay and lesbian and bisexual. These little lesbians, they're 13, 14, they're starting to have crushes and they don't want to be a lesbian. And so they say, I want to be a boy, just an ordinary boy who fancies those girls. And so that's a significant cohort. And Hilary Cass points to that in her research, that there's a significant cohort of children, and they call it transing the gay away, that are gay kids, pre-gay kids. They probably don't know yet that they're gay. Some of them might. And they're choosing to be trans instead. So that's just an aside. But the point that you know, this organization make, to say that the CAS research ignored positive evidence, that's not the accurate statement. What the CAS review did was they looked at all the evidence, they looked at all the research, and they had criteria for it to be accepted and eligible as high quality research. And they found that the vast majority, I'm talking like 90, 95% of the research, was shoddy, biased. Online surveys, one or two kind of participants, very, very biased research. And so it wasn't eligible. And so to say that it ignored positive research, it ignored bad research. It ignored shoddy, shabby research. That's what it certainly ignored. And it pointed to it. And it actually, she had teams of researchers, you know what I mean, in the University of York, for example. And they said, this was the criteria for eligibility into this study. And these are the studies that were excluded. And these are the reasons why they were excluded. You can't live on online surveys. Online anonymous surveys have been the kind of the support board for an awful lot of trans issues. And, you know, that isn't giving justice or good medical care to anybody who might have gender distress, because you're basically relying on very politicized activist people who are trying to get their ideological point across, rather than clinicians and doctors and researchers who are just trying to get the best outcomes for their patients. And so, you know, in the last couple of decades, the concept of being transgender moved from something that was to do with mental, deep mental distress, psychiatric disorders, plus, you know, physical interventions that kind of change somebody's expression and their style and their look, and huge interventions on that level. But they moved that to being a political issue, and this is some sort of human rights issue, and it's almost like they've conflated it with being gay. It's the same thing. You're just letting people be trans, but it's not letting people be trans. It takes hundreds of thousands of dollars to pay for somebody to create their trans identity. They end up infertile. They end up with sexual impairment. This is not like being gay. It's nothing like being gay. And it has been conflated with that.
I'll talk about the reasons for the movement in just a moment, but just getting back to this column on gayexpress.co.nz, because there's been a recent development just in the last 24 hours or so. This column says, the British Medical Association has reassessed whether to provide approval for the CAS report. This is a telling development. Yet I understand in the Observer newspaper, a Sunday newspaper across the UK and Ireland, there are many, many members of the British Medical Association, which I understand is both a trade union and a regulatory body. Many members of the BMA say the BMA has lost its mojo on this issue. Can you just expand a bit more on that?
You know, when I was younger, my dad used to say doctors differ and patients die. And it's horrible to see doctors, you know, disagreeing on ideological issues along these lines. What happened was CAS spent 4 years with her team carrying out research with university academic teams. She brought out a report. It is extremely high quality. And since then, there has been activist-led attempts to discredit her research. And for the BMA, which is the British Medical Association, to join in on that was was very disappointing. They've discredited themselves with this move. They said that they weren't kind of in agreement with the CAS review. And as a result, not 900 doctors have written, and they have written in anger and frustration at the BMA, who are disregarding actual research in favour of an ideological pursuit.
Well, and you believe that members of the BMA are embarrassed by their organisation? Tell me, Stella, though, of 900 doctors, what percentage of that of the BMA membership is that? It's pretty small, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know the actual numbers. That's a good point. But I do know, no, I don't know the actual numbers of how many was in the BMA with that. But I do know that that's very unusual to get 900 doctors to sign anything along these lines. It does suggest that this is a seriously unpopular move. It's been all over the media since they made the move, because they have not. They haven't pointed to any research to discredit CAS. They haven't given any substantial points to discredit CAS. All they have said is, we don't agree with CAS. They haven't given anything to the argument other than, this isn't good, this isn't kind, we don't agree with it. And frankly, that's very, what would you say, it's undermining themselves. Because if I was giving you an argument, I'd be able to, you know, give my reasons, you know, show your work. These are educated people. So they've really undermined themselves, because they said, we don't agree with it, and they didn't give any reasons why they couldn't agree with it.
Okay. You've talked a few minutes ago about the huge increase in those presenting with gender dysphoria in recent years, in the last decade or so. Do you actually believe that this is a Marxist move to disestablish the nuclear family unit, you know, the family unit which has been the basis of civilization, not just Western civilization, for eons? Do you believe that transgenderism is a way to try and break down the family unit? Because this is an attitude that's been expressed by many opponents of the trans movement. Is that what you think as well?
I think, but I'm not, I very much think we're in the middle of this. So I you know, I reserve judgment. But my feeling, at having studied it, and I'm immersed in it, and I'm literally doing a PhD in the subject at the moment, so I am very immersed in it. My feeling is that it's more that this is a symptom of the way society has gone. And so there is a kind of a cultural Marxism in society. It is a wave of cultural Marxism that's everywhere. So there's this feeling among most, certainly English-speaking societies, that if we are fair enough, and if we give enough kind of leg ups to everybody, everybody will be happy and everybody will produce the same level of work. So there's a kind of a cultural Marxism that is at play just in society in general. And so it's continuously trying to kind of give handicaps to different people, so that policy-laden, bureaucratic-laden kind of ideas, so that everybody goes to university and everybody gets an A and everybody gets a gold medal in the races, in the sports races. So there is a mentality that if everybody can win, we'll all be happier. I do think that's fundamentally against human nature, and it kind of absolutely misunderstands the psychology of the human. So I think that's what is happening. And in the midst of all this is things like the Black Lives Matter movement, the Extinction Rebellion movement, the trans phenomenon. And these are all different minorities who are saying, give us a leg up, give us more special rights. Because if we have more special rights, we will do better and there will be less sadness and unhappiness in the world. And so I see it more as a symptom of a general way of being in society that has really, really caught on, rather than that people are kind of plotting to stick in transgenderism into society to break it up. I do think, though, I have to say that trans and queer theory, and, you know, I've studied queer theory, it is fundamentally anti-family. They're trying to queer society, which means you're, you know, left is right, up is down. You're trying to make everything upside down because you're trying to queer it. Queer time is kind of change your concept of time. Reject child development because there's no such thing as child development. Everything is queered. And so queer theory is a pretty insidious theory. I really dislike it. And it's fundamentally promoting the dismantling of the family. And I think that's a little bit scary. I really think the family, it really is the kind of the center of society in so many different ways.
Of course it is. And it's not just in what we call the Western society or the English-speaking society. It's the family unit, no matter what part of the planet you live on. Stella, then, in terms of the reaction and the follow-up to the CAS report, have the recommendations been put into place across the UK and in Ireland, especially in the restriction and prescribing puberty blockers to, what is it, under 18-year-olds? Has that actually happened, and how much of a pushback has there been against that?
Well, yeah, there's been one huge development insofar as puberty blockers were banned, and I'm thrilled that puberty blockers were banned. By the way, they were banned in the UK, and the UK brought puberty blockers to Ireland, and they haven't been banned in Ireland. As an Irish person, I'm a bit bitter about that, but our day will come. Puberty blockers have been banned in the UK, and I think this is a huge move. And when the Labour government recently got in, they extended the ban, so it's going to continue. So that is great news. I really think we will look back on blocking puberty in children as one of the most barbaric things we've done to children in centuries. This is like worse than sticking children up chimneys. This is blocking their sexual development so that they have no sexual awakening. They've no crushes. They don't fancy anybody else. But not only that, they have no desire for a mate. So, you know, all that poetry and films and music that you like when you're a teenager, none of that is awakened because you're not kind of yearning to fall in love. You're not yearning to fall in love because you've been blocked. Your sexual development has been blocked and you're actually still in a childlike state, but you're growing, but your body isn't growing, but all your friends' bodies are growing and all your friends are starting to complexify and fall for people. And when you start to kind of yearn for somebody else, imagine you had your first crush and your second crush, you up your game socially because you come, you know, I remember I realized that I wanted to be fancied by other people. And so I tried better. Boys suddenly put more effort into lots of things because they want to be fancied. So there's an awful lot of development, social development with mankind that happens when puberty happens. We don't know what the impact of is of puberty, but there's all these children, and do you know that in New Zealand they had 10 times the prescription of puberty blockers in New Zealand as they had in JIDS and the Tavistock? So it's the highest, as far as I know, it's the highest prescriber of puberty blockers in the world in New Zealand. Now, when you stop a child's puberty, you've stopped their sexual awakening, you've stopped their kind of yearning to fall in love, to seek a mate, and then you give them a synthetic chemical puberty when they're a little bit older, and we don't know what is the difference. I know the difference between, you know, chemical food and real food. I know the difference, you know, the chemical version is never as good. And so this chemical puberty that they go into, we don't know. Maybe it just gives you kind of a certain kind of aspects of a sexual awakening, but not others. We are being like, you know, we are like Dr. Frankenstein here. We are significantly impacting children here. I think it's a barbaric treatment, and I think we will regret the day that we ever prescribed it. By the way, just so you know, the reason why I got into this was because as a child, I was a gender distressed kid. And had you offered me puberty blockers when I was 10, I would have bitten the hand off you. I would have loved them. Yes, stop puberty. This is horrendous, because I wanted to be a boy. And I was so sure that I should be a boy and I was going to be a better boy than anybody else. And I was so strong in being a boy. And I was so boyish. I really was extremely boyish. And if there was no puberty blockers offered to me, I would have been over the moon to get puberty blockers. But I would have been wrong, because the sexual awakening that I later had, falling in love, wanting other people to fall in love with me, finally having somebody fall in love with me, was what made me. And it became, I became very accepting of my body. And I now have two children and they're the best part of me. So I am very clearly, and from the very, I remember the actual day I first heard of puberty blockers, and I stopped and I said, oh no, you can't do that. It was an immediate response to it. Like, this is a treatment that people will look back in shock that we ever did it.
Wow. Well, we'll talk about the New Zealand government response to the CAS report very shortly, because I'm sure you're well up to date with the bizarre situation we have in this country, where our Minister of Mental Health, the first ever Minister of Mental Health, is a former worker at the Tavistock Clinic. But we'll come back to that very shortly. Did you not know that? I look at your eyes, at your eyebrows across the video link, even though this is an audio interview. But I just want to come back to one other thing in the CAS report. Was one of the recommendations to have a clinical trial about puberty blockers? Is that clinical trial underway yet? Is it a worthwhile exercise to go through, do you believe?
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about that. No, there's a consultation right now, and Genspect have submitted their consultation about these clinical trials. Our position is that it's not ethical to have a clinical trial. There's certain experimentation on children you just don't do. There is certain experimentation that is necessary. For example, for cancer and some really dreadful diseases, we accept that you have to experiment because these children are going to die. And so I get it. For something like gender-related distress, there's no evidence to say that we should be giving them such radical treatments. So we don't believe that it is appropriate to have a clinical trial. If there is a clinical trial, however, because there's already been a few clinical trials, we know the results, because there have been shoddy trials, there have been bad trials, but we do know the results, which is 98% of children who take puberty blockers go on to take cross-sex hormones. So rather than it being a pause button, rather than it being a kind of time to think, what it is it's the first step in medical transition. And they're taking it at the age of 12. And they're being told it's just a pause button. And at the age of 12, you love the idea of, oh, just pause puberty. I don't want to grow breasts. Okay, just pause it all. It's all too weird for me. Pause it all. Yeah, great. But that's not what it is. It's medicalizing the body. It's stopping sexual development. And it's beginning the medical identity of the person. Not only that, we also know that if you give puberty blockers, for example, to a little boy who wants to be a girl, this boy, his penis will never grow. And so if he wanted to revert back, he will have, a little 10-year-old boy's penis. So the likelihood of him reverting back is very, very minimal. But at the same time, his ability to have a functioning sex life is forever ruined. And his ability to have children is forever ruined. You couldn't overestimate how radical and invasive these interventions are. And that's why we don't think it's a good idea to experiment in this way on children.
Since they've been banned in England, and I believe also in other parts of the UK, has there been any development of, a black market for puberty blockers that you know of?
Yeah, there is. There's very significant money being made on the online market. And they're making it all over the world. These are, I would consider them mercenaries and charlatans, but they set up in certain countries and they know their countries and they know the laws of those countries, and they're online and they give, they give out puberty blockers, they give cross-sex hormones to anybody, frankly, who wants them, who'll, engage in a 30-minute consultation. And that 30-minute consultation, they don't even have to turn on the camera. They can just, basically turn up and you'll get your hormones and your hormone blockers. So it's a huge black market, and it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And there's no doubt about it, because no sooner as the blockers came in, but the mercenaries were advertising everywhere. So it does open up a huge market. And there are issues around that. There's no doubt about that. And then you start getting to, well, then maybe should you legalize it? One thing we want to do in Genspect is we try and bring an informed consent campaign so that parents aren't under the idea that this is some sort of pause button, so that parents realize this is the first step into medical transition and the child's sexual functioning is forever impaired and their fertility is forever impaired. So we want to bring awareness to it because of the black market. The only way to fight this is with information. And may I say, well done to your radio station for taking this conversation, because so many people are being blocked from speaking because there's such propaganda out there, as if I'm saying something dreadful when I'm just saying give better care to these kids.
I'll talk about New Zealand in just a moment. One other question before we get there. In your work, have you noticed any decrease in the number of children coming to you with gender dysphoria?
No, there's an increase in the number of kids coming because it's very much a social contagion. The more you think of something, the more you speak of something, the more likely kids are to feel it. And even by naming it, it's more likely. But there's also, on the other side, there's more resistance. There's more children backing out of it. So there's more children going into it and there's more children backing out of it. It's just bigger in every way, to be honest.
So there are those who think about it at the age of 12, but by the age of 15, they think, this is nonsense. I don't want to be the other sex, the other gender after all.
Very often when they start to fancy somebody, and if they don't have puberty blockers, you know, that's when it starts to emerge. You know what I mean? The sad thing is, like, especially since COVID, so many of these kids, they're living very disconnected lives. They're very disconnected from their bodies. You know, I remember one boy saying to me, you know, my friends are better online. The sex is better online. Everything's better online. And I was looking, I'm thinking, you don't know what you're missing, because friends aren't better online and sex isn't better online. You think it because you're 15. But actually, you don't know what you're missing. But these kids, because they're kind of from the COVID lockdown era, they think their friendships are better online. And they live in this very disconnected virtual world. And so they think they can kind of mess around with their bodies. They get really into their online persona rather than their true persona. It's really kind of screwed with their mind being online all the time. I think we've underestimated the impact of that on these kids.
All right, let's talk about the New Zealand government response, or actually the lack of it, to the CAS report. I don't know how much you're aware of the situation in New Zealand, but even though this report came out in April of this year, there has been no official New Zealand government response to it yet. What do you think of that?
I think it's disgraceful. I think New Zealand are whacking out puberty blockers as fast as they can. They are leading the way in puberty blockers, so they should be very informed and interested in the largest study on puberty blockers in the world. So it seems like a glaring omission that they aren't commenting on it and they aren't showing robust evidence about why they are not following the statements that have been issued within the CAS report. Why are they going against something that is the largest research in the thing that they are leading the way on in the world? It doesn't make sense, and it makes them look like they haven't done their homework and that they're hoping it'll go away if they don't comment.
Well, I mentioned before that our Minister of Mental Health, the first person ever appointed to that position after the election late last year, used to work as a medical health professional at the Tavistock Clinic in Britain. So for those people who are not familiar with that particular organisation and that particular institution, you might just like to give some background on it, because the Tavistock Clinic was doing such bad work, it's been shut down by the British government, hasn't it?
Yeah. I first started talking about this issue in 2017, and I just talked about my own very extreme years and years of gender dysphoria as a kid, just to kind of, because I was a psychotherapist and I often talked about issues, I spoke about that, and I ended up doing a film in the UK called Trans Kids, It's Time to Talk in 2018. And the whole time in 2018, I kept on hearing from medics, from lawyers, from clinicians saying the Tavistock is in disarray. The following year, 35 clinicians left the Tavistock, and they left in anger about the treatment that was being given to children. Now, this was the largest pediatric gender clinic in the world at the time. This is 2019. And since then, there have been a few exposés on the Tavistock, most famously Hannah Barron's book, Time to Think, which was a pure expose on a mess. This service was a mess. This service was not looking after the children, and they knew they were doing harm, and they were disregarding evidence from 2015 onwards that showed that this treatment was not helping children. And in the end, it was ordered to close. And it took a couple of years for it to close, but it finally closed in March, April this year. It finally closed its doors. And I'm thrilled that it's closed because I think it's been a discredited mess for many years now. And I've always wondered, I'd love somebody like Michael Biggs, who really followed the Tavistock for many years. He was like on their tail. I'd love somebody to do a kind of a follow-up of what happened to the clinicians of the Tavistock. All those doctors that were in the Tavistock and that had to leave because it was discredited and closed down because of the bad treatment they gave. Well, it turns out one of them ends up in politics in New Zealand.
Yes. I don't think he was a medical professional. He was more in the social work area.
But, could I point out something about that? It's very, very important that an awful lot of the damage is done in schools and in social work and in youth work around gender. It's a very important point. People think it's all about the doctors and they go on about the doctors. And obviously, I have a bone to pick with the doctors. However, it begins with very much people who are trying to be kind and be good. These are teachers and youth workers and social workers. And they think the kindest thing to do is to tell a girl who hates her body that she can be a boy. And that she'll be a great boy. And even though she's 5'2" and she's never going to grow again, she'll still be the best boy ever. And they think that's kind. And I'm like, it's kind of like giving a kid sweets. They're happy in the moment. It's not good for them, though. It's good for people to kind of grapple with the realistic expectations of their life rather than the unrealistic. And you have to move beyond magical thinking when you're a teenager into, you know, real life. And these, it's part of that kind of cultural kind of Marxism that is at play at the moment, where the instinctive feeling is, let everybody feel that they can be anything. Let everybody think that everything will be a success. And that's the kindest way to treat all children. And so the damage that has been done, especially in schools and around the world, where they immediately affirm kids and then the kids are stuck into the identity. Once you affirm a kid and you think it's very benign, and Hilary Cass said that point, she said social transition is not a neutral act. We think it's a neutral act, but we've never before done it. We've never changed pronouns on a mass scale before. We've never had teachers changing pronouns. We've never let girls say that they're boys and play in the boys' teams and call them boys' names and boys' pronouns. We've never done this on a mass scale before. There's no evidence behind it. There's no supporting quality research. And the only research that has come out that has been quality has said, this is not a neutral act and this should not be taken flippantly. And that's where I'd be particularly worried about the social workers, youth workers, teachers who think, ah, it's no biggie, I'm just being kind. I'm like, yeah, are you sure you're being kind?
Yeah. Bizarrely, when the Cass report came out in April, this man, Matt Ducey, our Minister of Mental Health, and the opposition, the Labour Party spokesperson on mental health, a woman by the name of Megan Woods, appeared together on a national radio show in this country, and they were basically singing from the same song sheet. I mean, on an issue such as this, it was just extraordinary to hear two opposition politicians whose, you know, political beliefs are supposedly at either end of the political spectrum, just agreeing completely. And of course, the line they brought out was, if you don't allow puberty blockers to be dispensed, then there's going to be a huge increase in youth suicide. Now, this is a hoary old chestnut, I understand. That is just simply not true, is it? And is often brought out by those who believe that puberty blockers are the greatest thing since, well, sliced bread.
You know the line from Alexander Pope, a little bit of learning is a dangerous thing. In so many cases to do with gender, puberty blockers, trans issues, politicians, youth workers, teachers, they don't know very much about it. They just say, what way is the prevailing wind blowing? Okay, I'll go that way. Yeah, that seems to be kind. It's the popular way and they go with it. And I bet my bottom dollar, if I spoke to either of those, that I would know a good deal more about this situation than they would. Because so often they don't know very much and they throw out a couple of old tropes. The trope that they throw out most often is around suicide. And you remember I mentioned Michael Biggs. He's a professor of sociology in Oxford and he focused like with a razor laser-like focus on JIDs in the Tavistock. And he kept on sending freedom of information requests so that he could get the full details of what was actually going on in JIDs at the Tavistock. And what it turned out with, through the freedom of information, we found out that in the period of time between 2010 and 2020, through the big explosion of the trans phenomenon, there was 15,000 children on the waiting list and being treated by JIDs, in the Tavistock, and there was four suicides. And of those four suicides, two were on the waiting list, two were being treated. And so that works out at about 0.3, which is not higher than anybody with any mental health issue in adolescence. This is a pretty, it's an elevated risk insofar as these are very distressed kids. They're much more likely to have autism. They're much more likely to have ADHD, highly likely to be anxious. These are distressed kids, but it's no more higher than that. This is not an elevated risk specific to gender dysphoria. It's an elevated risk specific to anybody who has a mental health issue. And so he exploded that myth with that information. The tragedy is, why was that hidden? Because surely that's good news. You know, surely when you oh, it's okay, these kids aren't going to die by suicide, it's okay, we can do less radical treatments. No, it was hidden. It had to be kind of sprung out of the JIDS through a Freedom of Information Act. Now, following on from that, I would like to point out that there has been a ban on puberty blockers for some months now in the UK, and there hasn't been a spike in suicides. There hasn't been a rise in suicides. And so not only that, I would point out suicide in general. I have so much to say about this suicide thing because it's a very badly, kind of very dangerous myth that's put around. If you look at the kind of rates of suicide, where were all the suicide trans kids in the 80s and the 70s and the 90s and the 60s? Where were all they? Because they weren't there. So there is no evidence to say this is a highly suicidal kind of issue. What there is there's an awful lot of propaganda and an awful lot of very political people who are determined to make this a political issue rather than a medical and psychological issue.
Della, can we talk then about your own experience? You've raised it during the course of this interview. When you were 10 years old, you had this feeling that you wanted to be a boy. A, is that unusual? And B, how did you overcome it? Or how did you change your thinking?
Yeah, well, it turns out, I didn't know at the time, I just thought I was an odd little kid and everybody around me thought I was an odd little kid. But I had it from the age of about 3 all the way up through childhood. And I was very unusual. I was very odd. I was very deep into this idea that I wanted to be a boy. And actually, puberty was horrible for me. It really was. It was a horrible experience. I gather it's horrible for everybody. So for me, it was just utterly harrowing. It really was. However, how did I get out of it? You know, how do you get out of any of the distress of childhood? You know what I mean? It took some years. Like I say, I did fancy other people. It turns out about 70 to 80% of kids who are gender dysphoric as children usually end up being gay, especially boys. Those girly little boys generally end up being homosexual. That's the usual. For me, it wasn't. I'm heterosexual. It's not that uncommon for girls. You know what I mean? Girls, some of them are lesbians, some of them aren't. But I think ultimately for me was moving beyond myself, having a sexual awakening, falling in love, having other people fall in love with me, and just coming to kind of accept. I remember somewhere in the midst of puberty realizing my body was changing, and I felt like every time I'd go to the toilet, something else would happen. I was like, Jesus. It felt like just completely out of control. It was awful. I hated my body. I laugh now, but I hated my body. And I do remember thinking, this is bigger than me. Have you ever felt like you're going to drown in the sea and the sea is bigger than you? And you think, oh my God, this is so much bigger than me. I remember that feeling as a kid, going, like, my body is bigger than me. I can't stop this changing body. No matter how much I try to remain a childlike, I can't stop it. I do remember distinctly feeling this is so much bigger than me. I can't fight it. All my determination. I had the whole town convinced that I was a boy. I had everybody convinced I was a boy. But that was worth nothing when it was up against nature. Big difference. These days, they're told, oh, you can change nature. You can change nature. Here, take these drugs and you will change nature. Now, giving a very immature mind that level of power, that you can change nature, you can change your body, and not telling them all the problems that come with it. You know, I had a reckoning, and that reckoning was very good for me. It was very heavy, but it was very good for me because there's sometimes you realize your will won't get you through this. Actually, it's bigger than you. You're going to fail. You know what I mean? That's a heavy thing to learn, but it's a big thing to learn. They're not learning that. They're learning, take some medication. That's what they're
learning. I suspect that your profession and the work that you do would be illegal in this country, because you probably know that we have a gay we have a conversion therapy ban. So that means that somebody like yourself proposing the kind of program to treat gender dysphoria the way you do, you wouldn't be allowed to operate in this country. In fact, you'd probably be arrested.
Yeah, it's a tragedy what's happening in New Zealand. And I understand the kind of mentality in New Zealand. They're trying to be progressive and they're trying to bring things forward and they think maybe they're leaving behind old, more regressive days. I understand that mentality. However, I think with this conversion therapy ban that they have, they are much more in danger of hurting gay, lesbian and bisexual children because those kids are much more likely to have trans issues. Those kids are much more likely to want to be trans. So they're inadvertently creating a problem where there wasn't a problem in the first place. The kid just needed to be let alone. Just leave the kid alone. They'll grow up. They'll find their way. They'll fall in love. They'll get there in the end by invading them with heavy medication to change their body. They are doing something so radical and it's pure conversion that they're doing. They're literally converting them from girls to boys and boys to girls. It couldn't be more the definition of conversion therapy. But it's a dreadful thing that so many, for example, people will contact us and we have some great members in New Zealand on GenSpect and we welcome any more who want to join up with us. But we have lots of therapists who feel they can't carry out therapy. Who really feel they can't carry out therapy. What a lot of therapists do to get around it, by the way, is they work with parents. And so you can work with parents as you wish, and the parents can parent their child as they wish to parent. They can at the moment, but more and more the nanny state is infringing on the right of parents to parent according to their own values. There are some extraordinary things happening in the world that are being done under the title of being kind, and they're really, really, in the long run, very unkind.
Well, it is remarkable what has happened in New Zealand in the last, 4 years. So what goes on in Ireland? You say that puberty blockers can still be dispensed, prescribed there. Can doctors see patients under the age of 18 and give them pills, which, as you've told us, has a major effect on their bodies? Can doctors give pills to these children without their parents' permission?
Yeah, Ireland is in an unusual place because we were really quite a conservative country until quite recently. And suddenly we've become the most progressive country. We're up there with New Zealand, you know, these little countries that are determined to show how progressive they are. And I'm from one of them, you know what I mean? So I understand the mentality. So, yeah, we can prescribe puberty blockers. It's notable that not many doctors do. There's a lot of conservative doctors in Ireland, so it's not huge. The black market, the online market is huge in Ireland. That's where they tend to go because the doctors, the GPs, the ordinary GPs are not really very interested in being part of this. This was considered a very, very fringe side of medicine for decades. And it's only in the last 10 years with an awful lot of funding, and it's an incredibly lucrative, very well-funded lobby, that it has become so mainstream. And so a lot of doctors, they don't really go towards it, but that's not the case in New Zealand. In New Zealand, they have leapt into it with both legs. They're absolutely, they couldn't be more pro, and they will regret it. And, you know, I'm really sorry to say that their history is going to come back to bite them in New Zealand. This is not going to end well, and they're going to be ashamed.
We have an organization in this country called Inside Out. You may or may not have heard of it. Inside Out is it's a charity funded by the New Zealand government to the tune of almost $1 million a year, whereby young, when I say young, I'm talking late teenagers through their 20s, maybe into their 30s, young people are going into primary schools. And these are effectively trans, lesbian, gay activists going into primary schools, I kid you not, talking to 11 and 12-year-olds, saying, you don't have to be the gender that you are at the moment. It's all right to basically become a girl if you're a boy or a boy if you're a girl. And this is government-funded trans activism in my book. And despite our change of government, and I presume with the blessing of this former Tavistock worker who's now the Minister of Mental Health, this money is still being paid out. This charity is still on the road pretty much every day talking to young people.
It's awful because the fact is, you know, the children are not, from what I work a lot with children, they're not coming out very educated at the moment from schools these days. They're not covering themselves in glory, the teachers these days, with the kids. And I know they're under awful pressure, and I actually have an awful lot of sympathy for teachers because they've been asked to be psychologists, youth workers, social workers, clowns, entertainers, and teachers all at the one time, but they're not kind of teaching the children enough. Instead, they're bringing in an awful lot of programs that is molding them to be a certain type of citizen and to think a certain way. And that is actually very much, it's like social kind of shaping, social engineering that's happening, which is a bit eerie. But secondly, there's a reason why we don't teach Shakespeare to six-year-olds, because if we did, they would mangle their understanding of it. They wouldn't appreciate it. They'd make a botch of understanding it, and they'd kind of have this half-baked understanding of what's going down. The very same, if you try and teach queer theory and complicated gender concepts to young children, they'll get a mixed up understanding. It won't be a good, solid understanding. It'll be a half-baked understanding. And that's what we're doing to kids, because people are determined to bring in this new concept that makes everybody feel good and it feels exciting and edgy. It makes the teachers feel cool and edgy. And it's just, we're playing with children's minds needlessly when we should be teaching them because they're in school.
Now, at the time of the CAS report's release, the biggest people in the pushback against it were from this group called WPATH, WPATH, the World Professional Association for Trans Health. Has that organization had some internal issues of its own in recent times? So what's the latest that you know about WPATH? Because there's quite a close New Zealand connection to it.
Yeah, PATHA, yeah. WPATH were started by this band of kind of a loose affiliation of trans people and clinicians who were interested in transitioning people in 1978. They were well-funded, but they were always on the fringes for many, many decades. And then they got a huge boost in funding in the early 2000s because a few very well-known billionaires transitioned, and they kind of put money into WPATH, and WPATH suddenly became this self-identified world authority on transgender health. Nobody else was seeking that title, and they became the kind of world authority, and suddenly they were given all these guidelines. Now, these guidelines have no evidence, and the guy earlier on, the Gay Express organization saying Hilary Cass didn't give guidelines, she didn't give guidelines because there's no research to support giving guidelines. You don't give guidelines to something that you don't recommend. And so WPATH are giving guidelines to something that there's no supporting evidence to. And they regularly give guidelines. Their last guidelines was the Standards of Care 8. It was released 2 years ago. And they beclowned themselves with it. They put in a eunuch identity. You know, eunuchs from back in kind of Roman times, the castrati. They brought in a eunuch identity as a fair enough identity that boys can seek out. And also the non-binary identity nullification, where children might just nullify their chest so that they've no nipples. And there's these kind of new identities and kind of surgeries that are taking place under the guise of WPATH and PATHA's guidelines that are not known in nature. So these are kind of new kind of ways to be a body that are not known of nature. For example, kind of shallow depth vagina, neo-vaginas and stuff. And also a vagina as well as a penis in the same genitals as such. Like, we're talking extreme modification, extreme body modification. And this is part of the WPATH, this kind of so-called authority body. But since then, Michael Schellenberger, and I worked very much with him on it, released the WPATH files, and they were released in March this year. And they revealed that not only did WPATH were they causing harm, but the clinicians knew that they were causing harm. And we have proof within the WPATH files. You just have to Google WPATH files and you'll find the proof that shows that they are actually know that they're causing harm to these children, that these children do not have a good understanding of infertility when they're 13, and that they're coming back later on and the dog isn't doing for them because they want children and it's too late because they can't have it. So there's something really dreadful going down with WPATH, but Genspec's response to it is that they've always used the hashtag no debate to silence people like me from speaking up with my very reasonable questions and wonderings. And so because they've always used this hashtag no debate, we've decided we needed to counter that. And so everywhere WPATH have a conference, we have a conference. And so they had a conference in Killarney in Ireland, and we had a conference at the very same time in the very same town. We did the same in Denver, Colorado, and we're doing the same in Lisbon in Portugal at the end of the month. So they're going to have a conference in Lisbon and Portugal, and we're going to have a conference in Lisbon and Portugal. And we're offering an alternative vision, which is, how about looking after these kids, giving them some mental health care, you know, letting parents be parents, allowing people to be, you know, if a boy wants to run around in a dress, he can run around in a dress. You don't have to medicalize the kid. You don't have to give him puberty blockers. You don't have to do anything with the kid. Leave him alone. He'll find his way. And so that's what our conference is trying to promote, while theirs is basically saying medicalize everything, because we are now in the 21st century and we can.
Yeah. Well, as you know, there is the organization in New Zealand called PATHA, the Professional Association for Trans Health Aotearoa, which is a name that more and more people are using for this country. And PATHA, pretty thick, it would seem, with the Minister for Mental Health. And he wants to get guidelines from them about the response to the CAS report. So you can see where this is going, can't you? Politically, it's a minefield, and I don't know how we're going to change the mind of the minister.
Yeah, that's one thing CAS pointed to. She pointed to the fact that there was all these kind of almost cartels working with each other, where one person would reference one organization, and then that organization would reference the first organization back. It's like information laundering. And so that one person might say something and they'd say, as the minister said in government, but he didn't have any evidence to support it. They'd put that into their research. And then he'd say, as this organizer said in their research, and they're just quoting each other. And it's information laundering and it's very dangerous and they're all doing it. So you'll find again and again that they're all very thick with each other. They know each other very well and they're working very well with each other. So, you know, what's happening in New Zealand is happening in other countries around the world. This is a global movement and they're working very well with each other to kind of support each other's kind of movements. And what they want to do is to kind of promote this medicalized version of gender identity.
Yep.
That's their big idea.
And I think the director or the spokesperson for GenSpect in New Zealand has written an open letter, not to the Minister of Mental Health, but gone over the top of that minister and gone to the full-on Minister of Health, Shane Rettie, who's a GP by profession, with an open letter. That was written in July. What have we heard? Approximately nothing. So, I mean, I rest my case. What is happening in this country on this issue is just extraordinary. Apparently, Mr. Ducey, the Minister for Mental Health, has even been given a briefing by his ministry about how to respond to the CAS report. He has still said nothing. They're obviously scared. They don't know what to do. They just hope that the problem will go away and quietly die in a corner. But I've got the feeling it's not going to, is it, Stella?
I've seen it happen so many times. Politicians all across the world, they haven't done their homework. They don't quite understand this trans issue. They think it's adjacent to being gay, and they know that people get into trouble for being homophobic. And so they kind of scratch their head. They're often a little bit freaked out by it. They're thinking, oh, I don't want to hear about genitals. I do not want to hear what that woman is talking about. Stop her. And so they very quickly say, yes, 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 it's fine, it's fine, it's fine. Move on the conversation. I don't want to think about it. That's one point. And the second point is, it's incredibly complex. Like what we were talking about there, this isn't simple. It's complex. And so if you're a politician who's just saying, give me the dirt, tell me what it is. And if the person who's given them the dirt is a very, very well-paid lobbyist, because this is a very lucrative industry, well, they will be giving them the information to say, yeah, no, it's perfectly fine. They're just medicalizing a small number of people. It's life-saving care. These children are all suicidal. They've just got their pat lines and the politician says, okay, right, go with that. That doesn't get me controversy. That gets me lots of warm smiles. I'll roll with that. And they haven't done their homework. And one day, you know that feeling in school when you haven't done your homework and you're just going, yeah, 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 yeah. That's what they're doing right now, and it's catching up with them. And it's quite noticeable that they're becoming less keen to speak about it because they're like, this seems more controversial and I'm being asked hard questions and I don't know the answer. They don't know the answer because they haven't researched it.
Where's this going to finish, Stella? Where is this issue going to finish? Who's going to win it?
I think without a doubt the numbers of detransitioners. One wing of GenSpect is we've got like, you know, we give, you know, funding for therapy for detransitioners, and we've more detransitioners, you know, coming on board every day. And it's very sad, it's very harrowing. But these kids, they wake up and they realize, why am I living this medicalized life? I don't need to live it. And they stop and they are angry and they're speaking out and they are furious because they say, I was a kid. Why did you do that? Why did you give me a mastectomy? I was 16. I remember one woman said, you know, I let a surgeon cut off my breasts before anybody had ever lovingly touched my breasts, you know? Like, we're talking serious tragedies are happening to these kids and they're very angry. And I think inevitably that tide will turn. Inevitably those voices will get louder and louder and parents will say, hang on a second, when their kid comes out with gender distress, which they inevitably will because it's so all over the world at this stage, the parents will remember having heard a story about a detransitioner and they will go slowly. And that's all we're saying. Go slowly, go cautiously. Don't use, you know, radical interventions. Least invasive first is the best option. And that will bring us out of it. But we've got some years to travel.
Stella O'Malley from GenSpect, thank you so much for joining us here on RCR.
Thank you very much.
From caps to tees and bags to bumper stickers, we have you covered. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.